there are enough rumors that floated around as to who was involved and who was in view. I do remember very clearly that Brian Chappell spoke to the student body and said, "We've instructed the police to do their work carefully and to do their work thoroughly, but don't bring accusations until you have concrete information, concrete data that really brings true implication. Otherwise, you wreck a man's career." Which made perfect sense to me, because you're going into ministry, you don't need to have those kinds of shadows following you when you go. So I brush rumors aside. Unless there's really something that I have to pay attention to, I will not. A rumor can be as devastating as anything else. And so I wouldn't participate and I wouldn't promote it. I wouldn't allow it to go forward, at least not with me or the people that I was with. So I knew that he was being focused in on. I knew that there were some pieces that said, "Oh, this really makes it look bad." Okay, that's fine, but is there anything concrete that is truly implicating him? You know, is it all just sort of circumstances, or does it really put the finger on him? And because I wasn't hearing anything like that, I didn't give heed to it.
Yeah, and then he left 2 months later. You know, he moved away to wherever they moved to.
I think that was his year of graduation.
Yeah, it was his year
he
of graduation.
Graduated.
Yeah.
That's Chris and Marilyn Baker, who were at Covenant Seminary in 1990. They were good friends with Elizabeth McIntosh, and they also knew Michael, the prime suspect in Elizabeth's murder. On May 15th, 1990, Covenant President Paul Koistra received a letter from Michael. On Koistra's advice, Michael had sat for a police polygraph examination a few weeks before. The results were inconclusive, but police still viewed Michael as the most likely person to have killed Elizabeth. Here's part of Michael's letter to the president. Quote, "Dear Dr. Koistra, because of the stand the seminary is taking in regards to my relationship to it, I hereby resign my employment as housekeeping supervisor at Covenant Theological Seminary, effective immediately. I will vacate my residence at the earliest possible date. Because I am leaving under duress, I do not consider myself as breaking my lease. Therefore, I expect a full refund of my security deposit. I would like to receive my diploma, which I rightfully deserve, because I fulfilled the degree requirements of the Master of Divinity before the unfortunate event of March 26, 1990. If I do not receive my diploma, which will affect my future career possibilities, I will consider this as possible grounds for suit." Unquote. This was the first in an ongoing series of correspondence between Michael and Covenant Seminary, lasting decades. These letters give a fascinating look into the mindset of many of the characters involved in this story, and how they each thought about their own involvement. Because even as the Covenant community largely moved on as an institution, many of the people who were there at the time were never really able to outrun the shadow of the unsolved murder of Elizabeth McIntosh. This is True Believer, Episode 9, What Happened to Michael? A couple of editorial notes before we get into it. The letters we'll be examining in this episode came from Michael's adult child, Carl, who in 2023 sent a document containing these letters to a number of pastors and other people connected to the PCA. While the letters are extremely valuable for telling the story of what happened between Michael and Covenant Seminary, it's worth noting that the letters originated with Michael, so we're only seeing the documents that he chose to include. We're working with what we have, and we're trying to keep it in chronological order. Although there are a few instances where we'll be referencing something further in the future and then circling back. It can get a little messy in spots, but we're trying to tell the story as best we can. Second, we've mentioned this before, but just wanted to remind you again that we've reached out to all the main characters you'll be hearing about from these letters. Former Covenant administrators Paul Koistra and Brian Chappell. Lawyers Mark Bells and Al Johnson. Michael and his wife Jill. And all have declined to be interviewed for this series. So, with that out of the way, first I want to hear from Jack Davidson, whom you heard from in last week's memorial to Elizabeth. Jack also knew Michael because they started at Covenant together in 1986. Here, Jack talks about his impression of what Michael was like on campus.
I knew Mike early on as, you know, it was a small class. I don't remember how many of us there were, maybe, I don't know, 30 of us, maybe 25. And I remember Mike and Jill. I think that Michelle and I were in a covenant group with Mike and Jill at one point. And I was in a lot of classes with Mike. We, complained about papers and professors, and he was very hardworking. He was very studious. He was interested in hard questions, theological questions. He was more the academic type, which I thought of myself as that way, even though I'm not really sure I am that way. I always thought of myself that way. But he was more that type and not the vision maybe that a lot of people have of what, you know, a pastor should be. And we were in a Christian ed program. We worked for one semester together with two other students on an education project. So we interacted, you know, quite a bit. I don't remember specific, you know, conversations with Mike, but I don't remember specific conversations with anyone anymore. But we spent a lot of time together talking or studying, talking about tests, you know, what was going to be on a test, trying to get ready for exams. It was just like any one of us. We were all pretty much the same in that regard.
Michael described leaving Covenant's campus under duress. But what does that mean exactly? Well, you need to understand what Michael was still doing on Covenant's campus in the first place. I say still doing because he'd finished his Master's of Divinity program, or MDiv, at Covenant in 1989, but he was still looking for an internship at a church. In the meantime, he was also still employed by Covenant in their housekeeping department, and he was considering starting an advanced degree program there called a Master's of Theology, or THM, which is basically an extra year after your MDiv where you focus on a particular area of study. Since he hadn't found a job yet, Covenant had extended his on-campus housing beyond what they normally offer graduates. Michael and his family lived in one of the newly built apartments on campus, and Covenant was in the process of building more. As you've already heard, Michael sent his letter to Paul Koistra on May 15, 1990. The next day, Michael's lawyer, Norm Steimel, sent a letter to Covenant's lawyer, Mark Bells, outlining the reasons that Michael would not be participating in Covenant's internal investigation, which they started the week before. Steimel essentially makes the case for all the ways that Michael had already cooperated with the authorities. And here's a recap. On the day of the murder, Michael gave written and oral statements to the police and allowed them to physically examine him. His apartment was searched, and some of his possessions were confiscated and never returned. He gave hair and fingernail samples to the grand jury, and he submitted to a polygraph examination at the urging of Covenant administrators and against the advice of his attorney. Here's Steimel's description of the results of that polygraph, which he tried to warn Michael about beforehand. Quote, "Although the results of that examination were inconclusive, the police immediately began to accuse Mike of attempting to manipulate the test. Instead of receiving any credit for having been willing to submit to the examination, Mike went from being guilty because he won't take the test to being guilty because he tried to manipulate the test." Unquote. Steimel also says that after Michael took the polygraph test, the Creve Coeur police called President Koistra, Michael's in-laws in California, and Norm Steimel himself to say that there was a great deal of concern for the safety of Michael's wife, Jill, and for their children. Here's Ruth.
Yeah, we don't have any detail beyond that phrase in his letter about, what the concern was or was about. We can guess that because Jill and Michael both talked about physical violence in their police interviews, that might have been related to it. But it's clear that the police thought that Jill and the kids might be in danger. Steimel, though, also has another spin on it where he seems to think that the police really were trying to drive a wedge between Michael and his family as a pressure point to get him to confess to the murder that they suspected him of. So Simul isn't really commenting on whether or not the concerns were valid. He's more commenting on how he thinks it was inappropriate for them to be leaning on them in that way. TJ, was it a surprise to Koistra and other Covenant administrators that people might have concerns about Michael?
No, I wouldn't think so, because, and this is sort of a chicken and the egg thing, it's possible that the police were saying these things because of an interview that they had done with Paul Koistra and Brian Chappell, I believe on April 27th of 1990. And in that interview, Paul Koistra tells the police about an incident that happened, I want to say it was earlier on in Michael's tenure at Covenant, probably 1987 or 88. And Koistra tells the story that he went over to Michael and Jill's home for dinner one evening, and he witnessed Michael essentially flying off the handle at Carl, Michael's eight-month-old at the time. Carl had done, you know, whatever, something that an eight-month-old does, and Paul Koistra felt like Michael was responding in a way that, you know, the kid doesn't understand what's happening. He doesn't understand why he's being yelled at. And the phrase that Koistra used with the police was that he had developed a theory that Michael may become psychologically abusive to his children. So I don't know if that entered into the police mindset when they were making these phone calls to people that Michael knew. But we do know that Koistra had raised this concern to the police about an incident that he had witnessed a couple years previously.
Right. There were the comments from Michael and Jill directly to the police. And then there were also some stories floating around about, you know, them being unhappy and maybe not treating each other and their kids correctly. I mean, not trying to diminish it at all, like abusive was the story. But what's interesting too is that the Covenant staff, at least some Covenant staff and students, continue to support Michael and Jill immediately after the murder. There's stories about people on campus still having them over for dinner, helping out with their kids. Wasn't there even a support fund set up to help with legal bills?
That's correct, yeah.
So clearly people not just supported them in general, but were looking for specific ways to help them out.
Steinmel's letter also contains an important insight into Covenant's internal investigation and Michael's refusal to cooperate. Quote, "I'm sure that it's purely coincidental that your administrative investigation seems to have commenced only after the grand jury refused to issue an indictment. However, the perception is that the seminary has brought in its own lawyers to solve the crime, the criminal investigation having been essentially botched by the Creve Corps police. Although I know the focus of your investigation is not the same as that of the police, it does appear that you will be drawing some conclusion as to whom the murderer might be. I'm sure that at some point, the police will want to know the results of your investigation, especially what you learned from or about Michael. Michael and Jill are understandably concerned about giving information to you, which might ultimately find its way into the hands of the police." Unquote. Back in episode 4, I read a quote from Covenant's internal investigation summary document, written by Mark Bells, dated September 28, 1990, and it describes Covenant's purpose for conducting the investigation. Essentially, Bells says that they are not trying to conduct a second police investigation, that they wanted to obtain as many facts as they could, both from their own investigation as well as from what the police shared with them, and that the end goal was to provide Covenant Seminary with recommendations about potential security concerns on campus. But Michael's lawyer seems to have had a different impression of the purpose of Covenant's internal investigation, that it was, at least in part, relitigating the police investigation. In a letter to President Koistra dated March 2nd, 1991, so almost a year later, Michael restated his impressions of Covenant's internal investigation. Quote, "During the last week before we left, Vice President Chappell told my wife and me that the administrative investigation conducted by your attorneys was for civil purposes to protect the seminary from possible litigation. We were told that it was an investigation of the police investigation to determine if that investigation had been handled properly. It seems now that your administrative investigation is trying, at least in part, to determine the identity of the murderer. This knowledge has only confirmed the prudence of our original decision not to talk to your investigation." Unquote. In the last episode, you heard lawyer Ryan Davidson, no relation to Jack Davidson, explain the reasons why talking to the police was a terrible idea for Michael. Here, Ryan talks about Covenant's internal investigation.
In a sense, the institution has its own incentives for conducting the investigation. Both their sort of first level need to know what happened and if they have an active problem right now, but also sort of second order, does this say anything about the way we do things that maybe needs to change? Does this, and the whole potential of civil liability both now and down the road is something that institutions always have to think about. And quick aside there, the reason institutions have to think about that more than individuals is because institutions tend to have more money and they have assets that are not protected the way that individual assets are. So the incentives to go after organizations and institutions that aren't true for individuals, which is why institutions have to be a lot more careful about things like civil liability. Anyway, the reason it's possible to give the advice, don't talk to the police, is because legally speaking, you really don't have to. You don't have to talk to them. And that is, as a matter of law, not allowed to be interpreted as evidence of your guilt. That's not true in the civil context. And if we're talking about employers or, say, a school with students, if you decide not to talk to them, there's adverse action that the institution can take. If you're an employee, you can be fired. If you're a student, you can be expelled.
In Michael's case, that's exactly what happened, as he explained to President Koistra in his March 1991 letter. Quote, "My wife and I left the seminary because of our decision to follow our attorney's advice, not to talk to those conducting your administrative investigation into Elizabeth McIntosh's death. You decided to follow the advice of your attorneys and invade sanctions against both me and my wife, which included being released from duty as a seminary employee and evicting us from seminary housing. You invoked these sanctions despite your knowledge of the difficulties and hardships they were likely to impose on my family." Unquote. About a month later, Paul Koistra responded to Michael, saying that his description of being evicted and leaving under duress simply isn't true. Here's Koistra's description of the circumstances surrounding Michael leaving Covenant. Quote, "Your letter intimates that you were forced out of the seminary community last May. It is true that we insisted that you leave the campus and your employment, but that was after and solely because you refused at that time to participate in our internal administrative investigation of Elizabeth's death. It was also after we had extended housing and employment privileges to you beyond normal seminary policy for graduating students, because we wished to help you as much as we could despite the police focus on you. As we explained to you, every student, staff, and faculty member at the seminary was expected to cooperate fully in this investigation, and your refusal to do so was simply unacceptable. Every other student, member of staff, or faculty member cooperated fully." Unquote. Here's Ryan Davidson again.
Those sound like the kind of responses that an institution that is taking a murder seriously would do. I mean, the woman was murdered, right? Nobody in any way involved in this is going to be better off. Every life that this crime touches, however tangentially, is going to be negatively affected. From what I've heard so far, it sounds like both Michael and the seminary were in an impossible and somewhat aligned, somewhat adversarial situation. They had no good options, especially once it became clear, as it seems it did to both parties, there's something wrong with the way this police investigation is going down. I've heard recordings that you've done with the officers. I've heard excerpts of the polygraph that Michael sat for. These are textbook police interrogator manipulation, textbook overconfidence of their ability to accurately interpret personal responses and reactions, independent of the content of what is said. I mean, listen to the questions that were posed in that sort of those pre-polygraph interviews. None of these questions were designed to elicit new material information about the case. There wasn't a single question there that they cared about to which they didn't already think they knew the answer. All of these questions were designed for one thing and one thing only, and that was to make Michael uncomfortable and to try and generate contradictions in the things he was saying. because those are can be construed sort of as inherently suspicious, and that creates pressure on him to try to justify himself. And the more he talks, the more suspicious he sounds, because as far as the police are concerned, if you're talking, you're suspicious. So what's Michael supposed to do here? He has no good options. The seminary doesn't either. Now, I think everyone would probably have been better off if Michael hadn't sat for that polygraph. To the extent that people connected with the seminary suggested that he should, that was probably bad advice. But knowing that someone is suspected of murder, what's the seminary supposed to do? And we talk about background checks, right? That wasn't nearly as much a thing in the early 1990s as it is today. But this is exactly the kind of situation that you would want a responsible organization to at least keep in mind. So as soon as the police started off down this rabbit trail, fixating on Michael, maybe they know something I don't. I haven't seen the whole file. But it sounds like there was definitely reason to be suspicious that this is, you know, not the world's best police work ever. There's just no good way out of this.
If you put yourself in the position of Michael's lawyer, do you think it was good advice telling him not to sit for Covenant's internal investigation, given that he had already told him not to sit for the polygraph interview?
If it weren't a murder charge, you really want to sort of play that carefully, because the police can't do anything to you if you don't talk that they weren't going to do anyway. But your employer can. Your school can. But things you say to your employer or your school are not privileged. And anything you say there, the police can ask the school, what did he say? And they'd be required to say so. They'd be required to share that. It's not privileged. So the advice, don't talk to the police, implies, yeah, and don't talk to anybody else either. Because anything you say to them, the police can learn about. And given that this is a murder charge, you really, really, really don't want that to happen. If it was something else, okay, maybe you need to weigh the you know, what's the worst that can happen on the criminal side of things? Is that risk worth whatever's going on the civil side? Hard to say. Sometimes the answer is yes. But this is a murder charge. Don't talk to anybody about this.
Yeah, really, TJ, there's no winning here. Not only is the murder itself terrible, but after the fact, I mean, what is Covenant supposed to do? But also, what is Michael supposed to do? If he's going to maintain that he didn't kill Elizabeth, like Ryan said, his best bet is to never speak of it again, which is what he has essentially done. I mean, we also know that he's still really angry about it. Even just as recently as this year, it still comes up in conversation. He feels wronged by the seminary. He feels like they pushed him out, made it hard for him to get work, and that set him down a trajectory that he's never been able to get out of. So there's like a real grievance that still lingers from his point of view.
So the week of May 15th, 1990, Michael moved his family to California, where his in-laws were living at the time. But his contentious relationship with Covenant Seminary continued. Remember, Michael had requested his diploma and said that if he didn't get it, he might sue the seminary. We don't have documents outlining these specifics, but we do know that at some level, Covenant admins were considering withholding Michael's diploma, which, again, he had completed requirements for in the previous year. According to a letter written by Paul Koistra on May 28, 1992, they had been considering withholding Michael's diploma at the time Michael mentioned possible legal action, but eventually they decided to give it to him. Koistra says the reasoning was that Michael had earned the grades represented by the diploma. However, they did not award Michael his full academic honors. Based on his GPA, he qualified for summa cum laude status, but the Covenant faculty unanimously agreed to only award him magna cum laude, because of his refusal to participate in the internal investigation. Summa cum laude required faculty approval in addition to the GPA, and apparently that really stuck with Michael. We've heard from former Covenant administrators that as recently as just a few years ago, Michael was still contacting Covenant, trying to get them to reissue his diploma with the full academic honors. And as far as we're aware, they still haven't done so. So that's all happening in May of 1990.
Then things go quiet through the rest of that year. Presumably, Michael and his family were getting adjusted to a new life in California. Jill got a teaching job, and Michael was also subbing at elementary schools. But then starting in December of 1990, Michael began preparing for a job in the ministry. He wrote a letter to the pastor of Grace Presbyterian Church in Moreno Valley, California, where he was attending, requesting a letter of recommendation for his upcoming licensure examination with the South Coast Presbytery. Here's Jack Davidson again, who was at Covenant with Michael, talking about a phone call he received from Michael around this time.
Yeah, we moved to Oregon. We started in ministry in Eugene in 89. I thought we had graduated together, but I didn't really know, you know, what had happened to him after I graduated. You know, there are always some people you're closer to than others, and there were four or five students that I was really close with that I kept in touch with. Michael wasn't one of those. And it was, I believe that when he called me, he was in California. And he called once, and I got a message from probably the church administrator or secretary. I don't remember if I returned his call or if he called me a second time, but we did connect and we talked for probably 20 minutes. He was looking for help. He wanted to know at the time in the Presbytery of the Northwest, I think he was wanting to pursue a call. A ministry call, and he was asking about the situation in the Northwest. And of course, I knew what had happened at the seminary. I knew about Elizabeth's murder, and I knew that he was a suspect. And so it was quite awkward. He came across as somebody who was genuinely shattered by what had happened to him, what had happened in the aftermath of her murder, that he was a suspect. He seemed genuinely troubled by that and, you know, maintained his innocence. It's one of those conversations that you'd rather, you know, now if you had caller ID, would you even pick up? But as I spoke with him, I felt the complexity of things. Like, here's somebody I know so well, and I could never imagine him. I just couldn't get my mind around it. It just was too bewildering and too troubling. So it was an awkward conversation. I think that I told him at the time that there was nothing that I knew of in the Northwest that was open, which was true. And also that, of course, any church has a responsibility for due diligence, you know, and a presbytery does as well, to be able to make an informed decision about a candidate, somebody who's presenting themselves for ministry. And I think that I told him that that process would be in place wherever he went. The presbytery's role of determining if someone is qualified and available to take responsibility for a church. I knew the man, and I genuinely liked the man when I knew him in St. Louis, and had no reason to ever think anything ill of him. At the time, of course, I didn't know anything about the domestic tension in his home. You know, there's the things that some people have brought to light later on, that just the tension between himself and Jill and some of the abuse that may have taken place in their home. I didn't know about any of that.
Michael seemed to be open to any ministry job he could find. He wrote a letter to one of his former Covenant professors, who at that time was teaching at Knox Seminary in Florida, asking about pastoral positions in South Korea. He also wrote to several more Covenant professors, asking them for letters of reference. One of them was Dr. Gerard Van Groningen. If you remember from episode 2, Dr. Van Groningen was in the basement of the chapel shortly after Elizabeth's body was discovered in the men's restroom. Michael asked for permission to use Dr. Van Groningen as a reference if he ever applied to another institution for an advanced degree. The rest of Michael's letter is more personal, talking about what he's been up to in California, and it also includes a section written by Michael's wife, Jill, who had been part of a women's group with Mrs. Van Groningen. Dr. Van Groningen responded shortly after, but his response is interesting in that it sets the stage for the next battle between Michael and Covenant Seminary over academic references. Dr. Van Groningen thanks Michael for his letter. He talks about the weather and a recent ice storm that came through St. Louis, but he completely ignores Michael's request to use him as a reference. He doesn't say no, he just says nothing. The reason why came a few weeks later, in a letter from Covenant's Old Testament professor, Robert Vashels. He and Michael seemed to have had a good relationship. After some personal pleasantries and catching Michael up on things going on at Covenant, Bashel says this, quote, "The seminary has been asked to defer all requests for references to the president or dean. Presently, I feel I should comply with that request and am encouraging you to direct your request to them. I sincerely hope that your aspirations for advanced studies will be realized." Unquote. Later that month, Michael received a similar, albeit curt, response from Donald McNair, Covenant's professor of practical theology. Quote, "As to your request, I gather that Dr. Chapel or Dr. Koistra is handling all references. They told me that you are aware of this." Unquote. Also that January of 1991, Michael received a letter from Covenant's attorney, Mark Bells, who says that he's writing because the seminary found out that Michael was seeking references from the faculty. Bells reiterates the reasons that Covenant asked Michael to leave his staff position and the campus, and then says this, quote, "You were not asked to leave because we had concluded that you were materially involved in Elizabeth's death, but because you, for whatever reason, failed to provide clear testimony at this time of unparalleled tragedy at Covenant. This failure is something which will mar any reference letter until it is cleared up." Unquote. Bells goes on to say that he'd be willing to go to California to interview Michael, or Michael could come back to St. Louis, and that the police would not be present. But as you've already heard, the police wouldn't have to be physically present, because they could just get the information from Covenant after the fact. Bells concludes his letter with this, quote, "It should be emphasized that during the course of our administrative investigation, we interviewed approximately 10 other individuals who were suspected, at one time or another, of having some level of involvement in the homicide. In all instances, these individuals were able to provide us with sufficient information to exonerate them. Nothing would please us more than to do the same with you." Unquote.
So, TJ, why do you think there's such a conflict between what Covenant's investigation is trying to do?
Well, I think because certainly Mark Bells isn't always clear in the way that he's describing what the purpose of their investigation is. In the investigation summary document that we've talked about many times, they talk about how it's for legal protection. They're wanting to make sure that there's nothing on campus. I mean, obviously, Covenant wants to protect the people that are in their care. And so what do they need to do to make the campus more secure? That's definitely part of it. But then there also is this implication in Mark Bell's letters of something that it would be reasonable for Michael to think that they are approaching the level of police work, because Bell's is using the language of exoneration. You know, people have talked to us and we've exonerated them. Well, it's not really the job of Covenant Seminary to exonerate people of the murder of Elizabeth McIntosh. That's the job of the police. So you can understand why Michael is not understanding what they're wanting from him. Also, I think it's important to note that in that investigation summary document from September of 1990, there's language in there about the investigation being closed. So at this point in January of 1991, it's not that the investigation was open and ongoing, but it feels more like what's happening here is Covenant gets wind that Michael is sending letters to Covenant staff and faculty requesting references. So Covenant administrators, Paul Koistra, Brian Chapel, their lawyer, Mark Bells, see this as an opportunity to have some leverage over Michael. Oh, Michael, you want these references? Well, why don't you come talk to us for our investigation, and then we'll see what we can do to help you out with this. So it wasn't that they were necessarily continuing to pursue him for their investigation. They just had this opportunity present itself, you know, it fell in their lap, basically. So they're going to use it to try to get Michael to talk again.
Right, which is why it's kind of confusing. Like, what is going on here? Why are you asking me these questions if the investigation is closed? If you're asking these questions in addition to this investigation, like, what are my answers going to be used for? I don't want them to be passed on to police if it's going to make me look bad. Like, I don't want to keep digging that hole. So again, I think it just kind of contributes frustration from both sides of like, what is going on here? And how do I move forward out of this? And really, that's what both sides are trying to do, but they may never be able to do that together. There's another piece of this where it's not just Michael corresponding with Covenant's administration. He's also writing to other people for advice, and they are writing him back with advice. And they are using religious words as they are talking to him. And so there's this interesting bit where somebody is recommending that Michael answer Covenant's questions, and he uses this word of, you need to submit yourself to their authority. And anybody who grew up in church probably recognizes that kind of language of, you are at a lower level and people with authority in the church are at a higher level, and you should just kind of trust them and do what they say and trust that it will all work out right. And Michael basically responds of like, no, that's not the water that we're playing in here. We're playing in a pool where I could get charged with murder, and that includes the death penalty. And so it's not really fair for you to use that language and to act like I am not submitting to authority and not doing my duty as a Christian if I don't answer these questions. So to me, that just adds another layer of complexity that impacts this case.
On January 15th, 1991, Michael responded to Mark Bells, and this began a long series of back and forth between Michael and Covenant Seminary. He says that Vice President Brian Chapel had told him in May of 1990 that he could use Chapel as a reference. So he figured he could ask other seminary staff for references as well, and he had already been applying for jobs using their names. He also says that, given there's been no real change in the circumstances, he sees no reason why he should consent to be interviewed. He also consulted wise and godly men in California who gave him no reason to change his original decision. Then in March of 1991, so a couple months after his correspondence with Mark Bells, Michael sent a letter directly to President Koistrom regarding Covenant's denial of letters of reference. He talks about what Koistrom and Chapel had originally told him and what seems to be a shifting message. Quote, during the police investigation against me, you and Vice President Chapel told my wife and me on numerous occasions that you both were convinced of my innocence. We don't understand why your investigation considers me in need of exoneration, if you and Dr. Chapel both consider me innocent. I don't understand how your investigation can clear me of suspicions, and neither my wife nor I recognize the need to submit ourselves to the authority of your investigation, that I may be cleared. Unquote. Michael says that he already told everything he knew to the police, and that according to his lawyer, the police shared Michael's written statement and videotaped interview with Covenant's lawyers, despite Michael's lawyer not being given access to those things. He also points out that Al Johnson, who had been working with Mark Bells on Covenant's internal investigation, had previously been working in the St. Louis County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, and that Covenant's attorneys no doubt benefited from Johnson's knowledge and insights of the police investigation. At the end of his letter to President Koistra, Michael offers a compromise. He's willing to answer written questions from Covenant's attorneys, but he also wants his attorney to get access to Covenant's internal investigation. About 6 weeks later, Paul Koistra responded. In a letter dated April 16, 1991, Koistra says that, to his knowledge, Covenant has not refused to give any references. However, they've been reluctant to do so. Quote, if the seminary were to answer such a request, we would be obligated to give a full and complete report. This would include, for example, your refusal as an employee and staff member to cooperate in a murder investigation, and the fact that the Creve Coeur Police Department communicated to the seminary that you, Michael, were a suspect in that murder, and that you should be considered a danger to the seminary community and to your family. You know that I did not personally share that view when the police issued that communication. But I'm sure you can understand, as you were told when you were here, that if the seminary is asked to write a reference on your behalf, we would be grossly remiss in our duties if we did not communicate that information to the requester. Such a reference letter would include any additional facts we might deem important as well. Unquote. So essentially, it's not that Covenant wouldn't write Michael a letter of recommendation, but that any such recommendation would be tainted. Koistra also adds that faculty and staff at Covenant are free to write Michael personal references, just not on behalf of or with the authorization of the seminary. He closes his letter with this, quote, we do pray that the Lord will aid and guide your family in this most difficult time. We wish we could be more helpful, but feel we are ourselves bound by your decisions. As a result, if there's no change in your decisions,
We do not anticipate further correspondence with you about these matters. Unquote. Here's Ryan Davidson, talking about Covenant's options for how to handle Michael's references.
If they receive a request for a reference, what are their options? Well, they could provide a reference and disclose that they're aware that he's a murder suspect. It's hard to call that a positive reference. Covenant would have had to do a lot of work to try and explain why they're giving him a positive reference while this suspicion is still on him, which, again, they can't do anything about. And it doesn't matter how problematic the police's suspicion might be, this is a given in the situation. And if we're talking about things like screening potential employees, screening ministry volunteers, this is exactly the kind of thing that you want to be disclosed. Not just, was the guy convicted, but is there anything to be concerned about with this guy? And being a suspect in a murder case counts. The fact that it's unfair that he's a suspect, well, that's sort of too bad. That's not fair either, but Covenant can't do anything about that. So provide the reference, disclose the suspicion. Bad. Michael doesn't want them to do that. Provide a reference and don't disclose. Well, Covenant can't do that. This is not how this is done. And not just because, you know, if Michael then does something bad later on, that Seminary could be exposed, but if anyone for whom Covenant has provided a reference or recommendation subsequently does something, that's going to implicate Covenant's practices for providing these references. And a plaintiff's attorney is going to have a field day with the fact that, oh, here's a murder suspect. You didn't disclose him. Why didn't you disclose what you knew about this guy? So Covenant can't afford to not disclose what they know, even if they think it's unfair. So the only thing that they can sort of do is to, you know, confirm that he's graduated, confirm his dates of employment and attendance, confirm his academic record, which is probably not really everything that potential pastoral employers are looking for. But as long as the police won't let this go, nobody has any good option.
At this point, it's important to talk about something Mark Bells supposedly said during the 1991 PCA General Assembly, or GA, the denomination's national meeting, which was held in Birmingham in June of that year. It's also worth noting that Mark Bells was the GA moderator that year. The moderator is both an honorary and a functional role that runs the meeting. It's a big deal in the PCA to be elected moderator. Anyway, during GA, Bells was approached by a man named Conrad Carnes, who was an elder at the PCA church Michael was now attending in California. Carnes wanted to talk to Bells on Michael's behalf, and here I'll quote from the document we have about this encounter. Quote, Bells was resolute in his refusal to relent on sanctions against Michael. He told Conrad that he had impounded letters of reference for Michael, and that he would never release them unless Michael and his wife talked, and that the seminary was not invoking these sanctions against him because of concern to protect the seminary from civil litigation, which was the reason originally given to Michael, but that the issue was Michael's refusal to submit to the seminary's authority. Unquote. This account impacted how Michael and his wife Jill thought about how Covenant was interacting with them. Even though the seminary had already told them that faculty could write personal letters of reference, Bells was now talking about holding them hostage. Or at least it felt that way. Here's Ryan Davidson again, talking about what authority Covenant Seminary did or didn't have over Michael. And one note, you'll hear Ryan reference the BCO, which is the Book of Church Order. It's essentially the rule book for the PCA.
Let's talk about what authority relationship might be in view here that someone might suggest Michael needs to be aware of. Well, the seminary is no longer his employer. And I mean, that's sort of the end of that, right? I assume you've had employers in the past. If one of them came to you and told you to do something, I mean, you can, but you're not under no obligation to, pretty much. Their authority as your employer ends when they stop being your employer. So it's not that. he's not a student anymore. He's graduated. So that's not it. And I actually was looking at the BCO this morning, and there is a sort of role for, you know, candidates for pastoral ministry. And there's an authority relationship, you know, authority hierarchy that they're part of, but it's with presbytery. And, you know, the men's session has a role in that as well, but I don't think the seminary enters into it. As far as I can tell, seminary is not in any sort of authority relationship that I can articulate with respect to Michael at the time this is, at the time we're talking about now. So even if it's a question of ecclesiastical authority, I'm not sure they ever had any. Michael's ecclesiological superiors would have been his session and his presbytery, not the seminary. Seminary is not a church court. Authority is a mutual relationship. And to be quite honest, this is something that officers in the PCA ought to know better. It's explicit in the catechism. Inferiors have obligations to superiors, but superiors also have obligations to inferiors. And each can sin against the other by violating those obligations.
In October of 1991, Michael's church in California filed a formal complaint against Covenant Seminary to the presbytery on his behalf. In the PCA, each church is governed by a group of elected elders called a session. Then a group of churches in a given region make up a presbytery. The complaint alleges that Covenant Seminary was trying to exercise temporal and police power over Michael through its investigation, and that the presbytery should conduct its own investigation of Covenant's investigation, which was, at least in part, investigating the police investigation. Here's Ruth.
Yeah, Presbyterians love letters and reports and investigations. Part of what makes this kind of strange, so it's October 91, Covenant had told Michael that he could request references from staff like 6 months before that. So it's confusing why Michael involved his church at all if there was nothing stopping him from getting references from former professors. What do you think is behind that?
Well, I think what's behind that is what Conrad Carnes had talked to Mark Bells about at GA the previous June. So yes, Paul Koistra had written Michael, I believe in April of 91, saying, "We've instructed the faculty that they are free to write you personal letters of reference, as long as those letters aren't being seen as coming from a seminary. You know, if they're coming personally from these people, that's totally fine." But then at GA in June, Mark Bells tells Conrad Carnes, "I have impounded the references and I will not release them until Michael sits for our investigation." So I'm sure Conrad goes back from GA and tells Michael, "They've impounded your references." So Michael's like, "What the heck? I thought I could do these things. Now they're being impounded again." So there seems to be a bit of confusion between what Paul Koistra had told Michael, what Mark Bells had told Conrad, who then told Michael. And I'm wondering how much of what Mark Bells said at GA, you know, Mark Bells was Covenant's lawyer, but he's also his own dude in the PCA. I mean, it's worth saying, at that GA, Mark Bells was the moderator. He's the head guy of GA that year. So I don't know if it's fair to say, like, Mark Bells has gone rogue, but I don't know that he's necessarily speaking on behalf of Covenant Seminary, or that Koistra would have approved of what he said about letters of reference being impounded, because I don't think that was true. They were not being impounded at that point.
Well, the seminary says that wasn't true. Doesn't mean it was a lie. It makes it all very confusing. Plus, this is mostly secondhand. Could be a game of telephone gone wrong. This is also reliant on physical letters getting sent in the mail across the country. You know, unlike today where you could just text somebody to clear it up, it's hard to tell where all of these things are coming from 30 years later.
The complaint to the presbytery kicked off a series of letters back and forth between Paul Koistra and members of the session of Michael's church in California. Just like with the polygraph interview in the last episode, there's way too much for us to cover in full, but we'll try to hit some of the highlights here. Michael's church essentially takes up his previous arguments in a letter dated May 2nd, 1992. Michael maintains his innocence. He's following legal advice. And most importantly, he's never been charged.
Therefore, Covenant needs to stop all disciplinary measures, restore him as a graduate in good standing, and seek reconciliation. Paul Koester responded on May 28, 1992, in a very long letter, not only responding to those points, but also giving some background on how Elizabeth's murder affected the Covenant community. Quote, "Let me begin by relating to you just how extraordinary these circumstances were. We had a murder of a female student in the chapel of the seminary. The murder was particularly gruesome and struck terror into the hearts of those not only on this campus, but in neighborhoods surrounding the seminary as well. Weeks of police investigation, media attention, threats of lawsuits, student and staff fear, special counseling of seminary students and staff, extra security, and endless questioning followed. Matters related to the murder, which require my personal attention, continue to come almost weekly. We had reporters from 5 different television stations and 3 newspapers trying to interview students and their families, trying to enter classrooms, and even seeking access to memorial services. And in the midst of all this, we had to reckon with the understanding that the murderer might still be among us, and all our lives might be in danger. Some people left campus for a time. Others sent their families away. Most simply tried to look to us for guidance, courage, and protection." Unquote. Quick side note here. Among the documents we've had access to is a copy of Covenant's newsletter, The Courier, dated April 19, 1990, so about 3 weeks after the murder. In it, there's a notice that due to the stress of current events, the faculty have approved a motion allowing any student to request a pass grade for a class, which allows them to receive credit for a course without affecting their GPA positively or negatively. There's a couple other interesting items in that edition of The Courier as well. There's an announcement for an Elizabeth McIntosh Memorial Fund, established by the Student Council, which would be used to purchase academic materials for the counseling department. Elizabeth had been a representative on the Student Council. There's also a list of scheduled chapel speakers. On Monday, April 23rd, Covenant's lawyer, Mark Bells. On Friday the 27th, Michael was scheduled to speak. Anyway, back to Koester's letter to Michael's California church on May 28, 1992. He goes on to say that, in addition to everyone else on campus, Michael and his family also needed, quote, protecting, which is why Covenant broke their own rules for graduating seniors and extended Michael's housing. But again, it was only after Michael refused to cooperate with Covenant's internal investigation that they rescinded their extended housing offer. Koester spends several pages outlining the reasons for Covenant's internal investigation and how important it was, in their minds, for Michael and Jill to cooperate. Not, he claims, because they suspected Michael of being guilty, but because, quote, "No one was closer to the facts. We never presume their guilt, and still don't. We simply ran into the impasse of our need to have them answer vital questions and their decision not to answer, even though such silence may yet be endangering this community and our families in ways we do not know." Unquote. Koester gives no indication what that current danger might be, over 2 years after the murder. He goes into great detail about the references Michael was requesting, and it largely tracks with what you heard Ryan Davidson talk about earlier. Covenant, and Michael for that matter, had no good options. Although initially Koester and Chapel had asked the faculty to refrain from writing recommendations, they had long since removed that restriction. Remember that Koester had informed Michael of this in April of 1991, over a year before. Near the end, he states that no one at Covenant wanted to hurt Michael and his family, but that he knows of nothing that Covenant has done that's been unreasonable, unconsidered, or intentionally hurtful. Koester asks, "Is it wrong for me simply to ask you to allow us to get on with our lives, to encourage Michael and Jill to get on with theirs?" In the margins of the letter is a handwritten note by Michael's wife, Jill. "We've tried," she says, "but this keeps coming up in one way or another." Koester ends his letter with this, quote, "Currently, I don't know what wrong we've done, and believe it would be best for all of our lives if we allow grace now to rule and let these matters rest as they are. May God help us handle this difference with love for one another Understanding that being in vastly different situations, we may not entirely see the other's point of view, but still don't have to view the other as intending evil. Unquote. Again, in the margins, Jill writes this. This is how we felt when we left, but letters from Mark Bells and you from last year indicated a totally different attitude. Over the next few months, there's two more letters back and forth between Koistra and Conrad Carnes, who was the elder at Michael's church. Conrad continues to defend Michael's position and reiterates the conversation he had with Mark Bells at GA, where Bells told him that this was an issue of submission to authority and not legal liability. Koistra refutes this and says the investigation was about alleviating fear on campus and protecting the students, staff, and faculty. Carnes suggests that Covenant accept Michael's offer to answer written questions under oath, but Koistra rejects that offer. Quote, while the investigation by the Creve Coeur Police Department is very much open and continues, the internal investigation by Covenant Seminary was for a very specific purpose, and as far as I'm concerned, is closed. I have no personal zeal to put Michael through any more trauma concerning the murder of Elizabeth McIntosh, and I have no personal interest in his answering questions at this time. Unquote. Finally, Carnes asked Koistra to consider an official apology for the mental anguish caused to Michael and his family. Here's Koistra's response and the end of his final letter. Quote, of course, I can certainly state, as I have in the past, that I'm extremely sorry for the mental anguish they've suffered. I do feel, however, that an official apology would be out of order, because the only thing that I could apologize for is that I have continually defended Michael and his innocence. Not only have I done it in the past, but I consistently maintain his innocence even in the present. I will continue to love Michael and his family and pray for their future ministry, that it will be very helpful and productive for the kingdom of our Lord Jesus Christ. Unquote. Unfortunately, that didn't come to pass. From the seminary's perspective, everything concerning Michael had been wrapped up. And in the fall of 1992, Michael did receive references from two former professors, and he eventually got a ministry job in Pennsylvania in 1993. But from Michael's perspective, the shadow of Elizabeth's murder and his possible involvement in it has haunted him the rest of his life. He moved around the country from jobs both in and out of the ministry, but he was never able to shake the stigma. Whether or not Michael killed Elizabeth, his life was effectively destroyed on March 26, 1990. And this had devastating consequences, not only for Michael and his wife Jill, but for their children as well. Next time. True Believer is written, recorded, edited, mixed, and executive produced by TJ Ingracia. Co-written and co-produced by Ruth Servin-Smith. Research and development by Kyle Hackman and Doug Servin. Visit TrueBelieverPodcast.com to see additional materials related to each episode or to get in touch with us. If you're someone who knew Elizabeth or have any information related to her or her murder, we'd love to hear from you. Next time on True Believer.
From 10 years old, my entire life has been shaped by the question, like, am I a murderer's daughter? Am I? And with the help of a really fabulous therapist, I think it was important for me to answer that question for myself so that I could move past wrapping my entire identity around my dad and this case.
Certainly, like, the things that I've lived through are terrible, but like the consequences to hundreds, if not thousands of people is immeasurable. And like the only way that all those people are ever going to have any opportunity of healing is if people start to say out loud what happened and to take accountability for their role in enabling this situation and to take real action towards changing the culture.